Mothers. Aren't mothers just the greatest invention in the world? Sure, all of us have mother stories. I would like to, by way of introduction today, tell you two of my favorite mother stories from my childhood. My mother had five children and felt responsible for probably only the first one. The rest of us were just trouble. But nonetheless, my mother was a wise woman. She worked on a very tight budget for much of her married life. And as a result, feeding five kids sometimes was a challenge. One of the things that was abundant were navy beans. Now, I'm not sure what navy beans are or why they're called navy beans, because, you know, they don't grow in the water. But like navy beans must have been what the navy people always used. Did anybody else know what navy beans are? They're kind of white, tasteless, chewy, terrible things. And I don't ever even see them advertised anyway. Everybody's ever see, hey, let's grow some navy beans. Like what? I don't even know what they were. But they were some kind of beans. They were a kind of a cross between a lima bean and a baked bean kind of consistency. They were horrible things. But nonetheless, we had lots of them and not a lot of money, so we had navy bean soup a lot. Of course, that was before we were in the church, hadn't been called at the time, so my mother would find an old ham bone somewhere, throw it in with these beans, and it tasted like mush and bones, you know, just, at least to me as a little child. But my mother was wise enough that to get us to eat the bean soup, which whatever else, well, there was probably other stuff in there. I just remember bones and these chewable beans that didn't have much taste. She would always have dessert. Now, rarely had dessert as a kid growing up, and I think most families didn't at that time. That was just something that was extra. But we knew when we came home or came in, if we could smell chocolate pudding, because those days there was no such thing as instant pudding. You had to cook this pudding on the stove with real milk and stuff, and I don't know how you made it, but you had to cook it. And then you would pour it into these little dishes, and then a crust would form on the top. And then you could pour milk on top of that crust and then eat this wonderful, unbelievable pudding. Now, my wife has memories of pudding like that, but the skin on top was just the grossest thing in the world to her. For us, well, that's what holds the milk up before you eat it. But my mother had this great way of eat your bean soup and you can have your pudding. Or eat your bean soup and you can have a canned pear. Now, kids today, I don't mean to be critical, but dessert canned pear. What? Like, what is that? I don't even know what a canned pear. Hunter, have you ever had a canned pear? See, it's just a different world today. You're so lucky. You probably have dessert like ice cream, right? Yeah, all right. Nonetheless, my mother, it was just one of my favorite stories that my mother knew that if we were going to eat this stuff that she had to feed us to keep us alive, you could at least get pudding at the end. My second favorite story about my mother is that she was always, at least as far as I remember, a happy person. And one of the things that I remember passing on to my children that I know that they will pass on to their children someday is when you put the kids to bed, you chase them up the steps, pinching their little bottoms the whole way. And I remember this shrieking noise my mother would make as she chased us up the stairs, pinching our little bottoms all the way up. And I remember sitting in the house with my four-year-old daughter, chasing her up the stairs and thinking, wow, how did I get to do that? That's exactly what my mother would do. Now, you probably all have mother stories. Some of you, unfortunately, have very sad mother stories. You didn't enjoy a right relationship with your mother. There may have been a lot of reasons for that, and I'm sorry for you. But mothering is a wonderful thing. I'd like to ask you a trivia question now in relation to this. Who in the Bible is called the mother of Israel? We know who the father is. Who's the mother of Israel? That's who we're going to talk about today. Turn with me to the book of Judges. See if your guess was correct. The book of Judges. Who was the mother to Israel? Now, some translations say a mother in Israel, but all the modern translations seem to render it a mother to Israel. What does a mother do? What should a mother do? I think as we go through this woman's example, we'll see great lessons for mothers. But we'll also see, because this is included in the Bible, in the Scriptures, that this woman's life provides us, whether we're male or female, mother or father, not married, single, married with no children, doesn't matter. The lessons that we can learn from this woman are for all time, for all of us. Judges chapter 5 in verse 7. You know who I'm talking about. The fourth judge of Israel. Judges chapter 5 in verse 7. Actually, we're going to cut into a middle of a song. Now, I won't try to sing it for you because the melody wasn't recorded, but we'll just read a statement from it. It's verse 7. The inhabitants, the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel until, in other words, poetically we're saying, the cities were in rough shape until that I, Deborah, arose. That I arose a mother in Israel. Now, she's not saying poetically that I became a mother, that I finally had a child. What she's saying is that Israel languished. The cities were in trouble until Deborah became a mother to Israel. Began mothering Israel. Now, sometimes mothering has a bad rap. And frankly, sometimes people misuse mothering. And they put an S in front of it. And it becomes smothering. Okay, get off my back. Don't smother me, mother. Now, sometimes people are accused. Mothers are accused of smothering when they're not at all. They're just doing their job. I remember telling my son when he was 26 years old, came home for a break. He's in medical school. I said, Philip, you need to tell your mother when you leave and about when you're going to come home. Dad, 26 years old, I'm in medical school. She's still your mother. It's not that you have to have permission. It's just information. She wants to know you're okay. So if worst case scenario, if you're going to be out, really send me a text. So that when mom wakes up and nudges me and says, Phil's not home yet, I can go to my phone and I'll get a text. Oh, Phil's staying at Steve's tonight. Okay, back to sleep. You didn't get a text from Phil? It's mother. It's just who you are. It's not smothering. But was Deborah a smotherer? No. Israel languished. The cities were in trouble. Israel as a nation was in trouble. Until a mother came on the scene. Now, we'll see that God prepared this woman, obviously, brought her to this position of prominence, and she became the judge over all of Israel. Men and women who had challenges, contests with each other, contentions with each other, came to Deborah for a decision. Let's go through a bit of her life to see what we can learn, not just as mothers, but as members of the family of God from her example. What might we learn from what was really a larger-than-life mother of Israel? First, what did Deborah do? What can mothers today do? What can we all do? First point, use insight to serve. Deborah was an outstanding woman. And she did not just stay to herself. She used her insight, her wisdom, we might say, to serve others. See, trend is in our culture today, I see what's going wrong, I keep quiet and complain to people about it. I see what's happening in the congregation. I don't want to throw this in. I complain to others about it. What did Deborah do? She came to the fore because she had insight. And she carefully and gently and kindly used that insight to serve others. Notice here in Judges chapter 4, back a page in your Bible. Judges chapter 4. We'll begin in verse 4. Ehud, the previous judge, has now passed from the scene. What happened? You remember the period of the judges? When there was a righteous judge on the scene, Israel did well. They were obedient to God. When that judge passed from the scene or died, Israel tended to flop back into problems, into idolatry. And then, therefore, they were taken over or oppressed by surrounding peoples. Once a judge came to the fore, Israel got their act together and began to obey God. God blessed them. He threw off the oppression. And as long as they were obedient, seems like that when that judge was alive, they did fine. When the judge passed from the scene, they went back into the depths of idolatry, back into captivity, cried out to God again. God provided a judge. In this case, he provided a mother judge. Fourth judge of Israel, verse 4. And Deborah, a prophetess. The word prophetess is the feminine version of the word, you guessed it, prophet. She was a female prophet. The word literally means an inspired woman. Obviously inspired by God, but also inspired by talent and ability, no doubt. Desire to serve others. By implication, this word prophetess is sometimes applied to a poet. And certainly she was. If she was the one that constructed and wrote the song that we excerpted there in chapter 5, she was a poet as well. Society does need its poets. Sometimes poets are made fun of, they're marginalized, they're kind of crazy people, which is sometimes true. But they're also sometimes very reflective people. And if Deborah was that kind of poetess, or poet, and prophetess, she was no doubt very reflective. She was very analytical. It's important for mothers to be analytical, not just emotional. There's a time and a place and a great function of emotion, but it's also a time for analysis. And that's what one of Deborah's strengths, no doubt, was. Being, in essence, a poet or lyricist, you reflect more. How can I state it in such a way that makes sense, or that categorizes something, or explains something, or gives us insight about something? Deborah used her insight as a poetess, as a prophetess, to serve others. Let's go on. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. So she was also a wife. Now, we're not told specifically about children that she bore. Maybe she had children, maybe she did not. Maybe not having children allowed her to serve in a way that she would not have otherwise been able to serve. That's possible as well. Nonetheless, she judged Israel at that time. Now, we could say, I think, pretty clear, or at least the implication of verse 4 is, that she was a prophetess, so her insight was based upon a solid relationship with God. Extremely important for us as God's people, for mothers individually, to base their job, their responsibilities, first with that solid relationship with God. If we've got an issue with our husbands, with our children, with our bosses, with our co-workers, where do we start for the solution? Well, we start with our relationship with God. We pray about this. We might fast about these things. We beseech God for insight and wisdom. We search His Word for applicable examples that could be useful in the situations that we're dealing with. The word Deborah, the name Deborah, apparently means bee, as in buzzing bee, which would be interesting. Was that part of her character? Did she go from flower to flower helping, serving? Ever sit and watch? I just happened to be sitting a few weeks ago under a cherry tree in full blossom. Sat there for about an hour. And it was fascinating to hear the buzzing of all these bees. Now, there must have been 50 or 60 bees, various varieties, some bumblebees, some wasp-type bees, probably a couple honeybees. They were all buzzing around, servicing these flowers, doing their job, cooperating completely, nobody fighting with each other, just doing the job. Now, maybe Deborah was that kind of person that wherever the need was, she would go to and serve and help. And I know lots of ladies in God's church like that. that they're not out to sting other people, but they're there to serve. And they go from spot to spot, issue to issue, family to family, place to place, serving and helping and giving. Deborah used this insight to serve Israel. And her insight was so keen that people from all over, apparently the nation, would come for judgments, for wisdom, for insight. Oh, that we would have more Deborahs today. And we have any number, I'm sure. But people want to come to a Deborah for insight, for understanding. They realize that this woman is a poetess. She's got insight. She's got special insight. Israel will want a decision from her on what is right and what is wrong. Now, when things are black and white, you don't need advice, do you? Should I steal this or should I not? Well, it's pretty black and white. You steal it or you don't. At the same time, there's lots of areas in our lives that are kind of, well, what is exactly right about this? Okay, I'm on the job. I'm supposed to. They say coffee's here. It's a donation. Okay, I give a donation for coffee. Is this like a Starbucks donation, or is this a Dunkin' Donuts donation, or is this a Speedway donation, or is this a home coffee donation? Because there's a big difference between the 4-cent cup of coffee that I can make at home, and I literally have checked that out, so I know that's true, and the $4.75 Starbucks coffee that I can buy there. So give me some insight. Am I stealing if I only give 4 cents? A lot of people say, well, you dirty, rotten cheapskate, what's wrong with you? And of course, this is a silly example, but there are a lot of areas in life that are very, boy, how do I handle this? What is the best way to do this? And they almost always deal with stuff or people. Almost always deal with people. So undoubtedly, Deborah would have certainly worked with things in rendering judgments. But more often than not, it's just the stuff. What you got to work through is the people issues. Okay, you owe them this. I don't think I owe them that. Is that a thing issue or is it a people issue? It's a people issue. So Deborah must have had intensive skills in dealing with helping people resolve people issues. Once the people issue is resolved, the stuff issue usually comes along a lot more easily. So she used her God-given ability to give verdicts. Now, we're not sure during the time of the judges in Israel whether or not those decisions rendered were like our court decisions today. In a court in America or Britain or the Western world, once the judge makes a decision, that's it. Everybody agrees and they go do it. Now, whether or not this was just advice, whether it was binding in some way, we're not exactly told. The history of Israel just is not very clear that way. How do they enforce decisions? You see, today in our nation, a judge makes a decision, and it's enforced by the system, by the police if necessary. We're not told that it was this way. It seems that the issue in Israel was more a negotiation. Let's sit down, let's talk this out, we'll sit in the gate, we'll talk about these things, we'll come to a conclusion everybody can live with, and we'll all go our way. A lot better system, frankly, than the one we have now, where you don't do these things. You fight and fight and fight until somebody's right, somebody's wrong. You lose, I win, we're done. It doesn't build relationships very well. Deborah must have been a good relationship builder. Okay, John, all right, you got 100 sheep. I understand that. Billy, you got 99 sheep. You think 2 of his sheep are your sheep. Can we work this out? Can we sit down and talk about this? How's your family, by the way? How's your sweetheart? Is she doing okay? How about that oldest son? I know he was causing you some problems. Is he doing better now? Can you just see this Jewish woman kind of working these things out? Oh, Johnny! The last time you talked to me, we had a sheep problem. You got sheep problems like this? What's going on here? I don't know what she was like, but I just kind of picture this Barbara Streisand kind of woman. Like, we can work this out. Can we? Can we work this out? Yes, we can. Let's sit down here. Come on. Hey, bring him something to eat. I don't know what she was like, but you wonder. Somehow she was able to work this situation out. Second thing we can learn from Deborah is this. Don't go it alone. As talented a person as Deborah was, she realized that there are limits. There were limits for a woman in Israel, no doubt. And there were a limit in regard to how she could best serve her people. There were some things that she could do, working out these relationships, working out judgments, helping people get along, solving their disputes, serving here and there. But she realized what Israel would need at this point was a general. And that was not where she would be able to serve. Let's again look at Judges chapter 4. In verse 4, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. It was basically the leader of the nation, we might say, the prime minister kind of role. Verse 5, she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim. So here she is, probably an Ephraimite because she lived there. But nonetheless, she had this location. People would come to her for judgments. And the children of Israel came to her for judgment, verse 5. And then in verse 6, she sent and called Barak, or Barak. Barak isn't a real popular name sometimes these days. But that's probably how it was pronounced. Barak, the son of Abinoam, and said unto him, has not the eternal God of Israel commanded, saying, go and draw toward Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men, the children of Naphtali and the children of Zebulun? Remember, she was a prophetess. Apparently, God gave her a message. And the message was not, Deborah, gather an army and go fight. Throw off this oppression. Israel starting to be obedient. I'm going to grant them relief from their enemies. She realized it was not her place to do that. She needed to include others, in this case Barak, to work together to throw off the oppression of those who were torturing Israel. Many times in our culture, women are tempted to believe, and they are constantly being told, that you can go it alone. You can do it all. And the simple truth is, no, you can't. Ask any woman who thinks, oh, I can do it all. I don't need anybody. And you ask, is that a happy person? Is that a person who's filled with joy and giving? Is that the kind of person you want to be around? I know some women like this. You might know them as well. Can you just not wait to be in their presence? Or do you want to run? Some of you may work for bosses like that. Like, boy, this woman does it all. She's got a husband. She's got kids. She's got a house. She's got a mortgage. She's got this. She's got that. And she's got trouble. Emotional troubles. Physical troubles, spiritual troubles. That's not to say you can't do a lot. Women are amazing at multitasking. We men have one box at a time. Let's take care of this box. We'll do that, and then we'll put that box back, and then we'll take this one out. Women have 8 boxes open at once, and they're doing that. I was watching my wife yesterday a little bit, preparing for company. We're having the pleasure of having Jonathan's grandparents stay with us tonight. And so my wife is, I literally must have been doing 10 things at once. She was moving so fast, she reminded me of an octopus. There's arms everywhere, and then they're scrubbing this and cleaning that and baking this and bringing that, and then, okay, let's have a little basket together in the bedroom so that there's a granola bar and a couple of waters in there. And wow, I was thinking, just change the sheets, you know, that's all. She's got a duster, she's got a gift basket, she's got food, she's got water. Wow. So women are able to accomplish an amazing amount. At the same time, being alone is hard. And in this case, she saw that, you know, to have a woman general over the army just isn't appropriate. She understood that there were certain limits. Now, again, in our culture, women are encouraged basically to think and to feel and to pursue life as if they need no one. It's very destructive for our culture. It's interesting, we did a presentation not too long ago at Foundation Institute on the concepts of masculinity and femininity. And what was interesting to me as you research some of this, that most superheroes now, and I don't mean fables, but the action stars of today are mostly women. It's an interesting transition, even over the last about 15 years. You have a movie. How many of you have seen The Expendables or Expendables 2? Okay, three of us. I'm sorry. Expendables is a movie. Okay, there's four. So the point is of this movie, I'm not sure what the point of either of the movies are, but they have all the male action stars of like the last 20 years in them. And they're all old guys. They're like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's what, 80? He still will beat you up, but he's like 80. And Sylvester Stallone, and I forget who else is in these movies, but they're all old guys. So you type in action hero on your Google, and you'll get a list of about 15 women that are probably age 20 to 25 or 30 maybe. So you got the Angelina Jolies and the, who's Kate Beckinsale, my son says, Kate Beckinsale. He's single, he can say those things. But the point is, they're all women. You can beat up men, you can beat up anybody else, shoot them, cut them, stab them, and you are somebody. And this is what we're holding up to our little girls as what we want you to be. It's just a lie. I don't care how athletic this 5'6" woman is, I will shoot her in a heartbeat if I wanted to. She can be as tough as nails. She's not going to survive. Do we have 5'6" women on the front lines of combat? No. Why? Because they can't compete that way. They shouldn't be trying to. And yet, social experiment, we're going to put them on the front lines in combat. It's ridiculous. It is idiotic. It is foolishness. Deborah understood there are certain places I just don't belong. Men understand there are certain places we just don't belong. You know, they're just different roles. It's okay. It's okay to have different roles. You don't have to compete with men. You don't have to. Do not fall for this cultural lie that you women have to compete with men and that you're nobody unless you do. It's wrong. It's absolutely backwards. Deborah understood. You got a general, you need a man. That's not to say men are better, they're just different. We each have our unique and beautiful skills and abilities that we want to emphasize. Deborah understood that to have an army, she needed a man to take care of that. God gave her an insight into who that should be. Verse 7, she says, I will draw unto you to the river Kishon Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitudes, and I will deliver him under your hand. So it seems as if God is speaking directly to Barak through Deborah. He says, I'm going to draw these people, your enemies, to this place, and you're going to destroy them. She realized she could not go it alone. And again, you might know people like that. Women who feel they can go it alone, who feel they should go it alone, are almost inevitably unhappy people. Why? Because God created them to do what? To be a help. Not to be alone. To be a loner. Not to do it alone. God said to Adam, I will create a help suitable for you. Well, that's not to say she's inferior in any way. If two people need to work together to make something happen, one's not inferior. You got to work as a team. And that's certainly the case. It's the way God has set up life. What other skill did Deborah have? I'd like to point out another one, a third thing we can learn from Deborah. She learned how to preserve others' dignity. Sometimes we can see what's wrong. We know someone is doing something wrong. And we can slash and burn, as we say, correct them in a harsh manner, or just draw attention to what they're doing wrong or how they're failing, and we can ruin a relationship, ruin any ability to work together in the future, or at least for a long time. Deborah was able to understand that people need, as we read in the New Testament, to be honored. What did Peter say? Honor all men. All. He didn't say just the nice ones or the good ones. The ones that are doing what they should or are on track right now. He said, honor all. And Deborah understood that. She understood how to preserve other people's dignity even when they needed correction. What happened? Let's look in verse 8. Deborah calls Barak, tells him she's got a message from God. God's going to draw the enemies. He's to be the leader of the army. Verse 8. Barak said to her, well, if you'll go with me, then I'll go. Now, we might be saying this is not a real man's man. Well, Mom, if you'll go with me, then I'll do this, but I'm not going by myself. Now, maybe that wasn't Barak. Maybe we're reading more into that than is actually there. Maybe he just felt she would be the rallying point. Here's the mother of Israel standing on the hillside, rallying the troops. Maybe that's what he meant. But she could have said, well, you little baby, do I need to change your diaper? You're a man, aren't you? Get out there and do your job. Well, she could have said that. She might have been accurate. But she didn't. She preserved his dignity. There is one great key that all wives and mothers need to understand. And that is, men's dignity needs to be preserved. Oh, it's been made fun of. It's the male ego. It's this, it's that. You can call it whatever you want. It is there. And it is a part of a man's nature. So a man who feels respected feels loved. And oftentimes women simply miss that. They think, well, I love my husband. I do his laundry. I cook his food. Of course he knows I love him. If he does not feel honored, if he does not feel respected, he will not feel loved. Respect and love in a man's mind basically are the same thing. It's a great survey a number of years ago that a woman did. As she tried to understand men. And she asked the question, which would you, if you had to choose between these two things, which would you choose? Would you rather be absolutely disrespected and all around people, or would you rather be unloved? Which would you rather have? Would you rather be disrespected or unloved? And almost 100% of the men said, I would much rather be unloved than disrespected. Almost 100%. It's a fascinating thing. You ask the same question to women, what do you think the answer was? Almost exactly the opposite. Oh, I'd much rather be disrespected than unloved. Oh my, I couldn't stand not being loved. Man says, I can't stand being disrespected. So Deborah here somehow was able to preserve Barak's honor in spite of what appeared to be, or at least appears on the surface to be, kind of the chicken kind of mentality here. Well, if Mom, if you go with me, then I'll go. Okay. Now again, maybe I'm reading much more into that than is necessary. But you might like to hold a finger here, or as we said before, get out your 3x5 card and put it in Judges 4. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 14. Deborah understood this apparently on the national level. And she probably understood it on the personal level as well, and maybe her family level. But Proverbs chapter 14, verse 1, is a principle that she enacted as far as the nation was concerned. And something that certainly our women, and certainly our men, and by extension as well, can and should learn. Solomon noted this, Proverbs 14, verse 1, the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish, the King James says, plucks it down. The foolish, New American Standard says, tears it down with her own hands. Now, is that literally true? And the answer is no. We're not talking about hands. What does she usually tear it down with, this unwise woman? The tongue. Almost always. I mean, I don't know too many women over the years, haven't known too many women who just destroy their house, throwing pots and pans and ripping stuff off walls and kicking in windows and doors. What's this talk? Talking about our tongue. Deborah understood that she could have humiliated Barak for his, what was apparently some cowardice maybe, but she built that house instead. We build our houses first and foremost with our mouth, with our words, and then secondarily with our actions. Let's turn back to Judges chapter 4 where we left off. Barak said in verse 8, if you'll go with me, then I'll go, but if you will not go with me, then I'll not go. So did he at the very least, lack faith? Yes. He had a message from God and he didn't follow. Verse 9, she said, I will surely go with you. Absolutely. She could have said something very insulting, but she didn't. I will surely go with you. Now, she did say there's a condition, notwithstanding the journey that you take shall not be for your honor. For the Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. So she did let him know that, okay, there is, it seemed like at least a bit of a penalty for that lack of faith. Probably not for his lack wanting her along, but just a lack of faith. God says, I should go there. I don't think I can't do that yet. If you come with me, I will. So you might remember the story how Sisera was given into the hand of a woman who finally put him to death and allowed Israel to escape from this kind of oppression that they were suffering at the time. Again, hold your spot here in Judges 4. Put the card there. Turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 25. 1 Samuel chapter 25. We have an interesting story here that we'll just touch on for a few moments. It's the story of Nabal and Abigail. I just want to touch on it because we have a similar situation where Abigail lives in a rather unsavory circumstance, but somehow is still able to show honor to her husband. Now you might remember that her husband's name was Nabal. Nabal, the word means fool. Now, I guarantee this was not a marriage that Abigail chose. Not too many people out there say, you know what? I'd really like to marry fool over there. This was no doubt an arranged marriage. He probably didn't have any choice in this. You know, on the day it was announced, sweetheart, I've arranged for your marriage. Going to marry a nice man. He's a nice man. He lives over the hills there. He's got lots of sheep. He's a nice sheep herder. Well, what's his name, Daddy? He's a great man. He really has lots of stuff. You'll be well taken care of. What's his name? Fool. No, not fool. Not him. Dad. I don't know what that is. Of course, I'm making this up. Point is, Abigail's name means great joy. For whatever reason, Dad named this kid Fool. Now, maybe that was a nickname later on, but he was. So Abigail, great joy, is married to Fool. 1 Samuel 25 in verse 2. There was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. The man was very great. And he had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats was shearing his sheep in Carmel. This was a very wealthy man. Now you remember the story. He insults David's men, insults David. David's men were around his sheep herd the entire summer, guarding it, protecting it from raiders and from onslaughts. So he was very kind. His men provided a service. And of course, Nabal insults David. David sends some of his men, do you think you could spare a few provisions for us? And the guy basically says, who is David? I don't know this. Ooh, you wanderer, you know, I don't need you. They provided a wonderful service all year, sparing his flocks from being stolen and maybe himself from being killed. And he's spurned as a result. Down in verse 14. One of our young men told Abigail, of course, David says after he's insulted like this, I'm just going to kill the guy. He's a fool. I'm just going to kill him and take all his stuff. That'll teach him a lesson. You don't teach people lessons by killing them usually. You know? It's hard to learn when you're dead. But David was angry. His emotions got the best. I'm just going to kill him. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers out in the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them. The men were very good to us. We were not hurt, neither missed anything as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They watched out for us. They didn't steal a thing. They protected us. They were a wall unto us by night and day, all the while we were keeping the sheep. They protected us. We really do owe them something. We would have lost great amounts if it wasn't for them." Verse 17. "Now therefore know and consider what you will do. For evil is determined against our master and against all his household. For he is such a son of Belial that man cannot speak to him." He couldn't deal with this guy at all. Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves, 2 bottles of wine, 5 sheep ready dressed, 5 measures of parched corn, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on asses or donkeys. She said to her servants, "Go before me. Behold, I come after you." But she told not her husband Nabal. Was she rebellious? Not at all. We're hearing this story explained many years ago. Well, she was a rebellious wife, but God overlooked that. No, that's just not true. She was preserving her family. She was using great wisdom and judgment. And frankly, she strove at the same time to preserve her husband's dignity. She could have gone and railed all over him in front of everybody else. "Why, you idiot, how could you do something so stupid? Do you know who you're dealing with there? This is a man of war. He has killed hundreds of Philistines by himself, and you insult the man? What's wrong with you? You are an idiot. You are a fool. But she didn't. She simply made the preparations that were necessary to spare the lives of the entire family and all their servants and all their possessions, and did what needed to be done. Now, certainly we must be cautious in preparing and using this example in very wide ways in our own families. I mean, this is a life and death matter. This isn't, "The idiot spent another $50 on this. I'm taking the rest of the money, putting it in a separate account because the fool doesn't know how to use money." Totally different story. Point is, work these things out. Here, she had to act quickly to save her own life, her husband's life, her children's lives, all the lives of the servants, all their possessions. Goes on in verse 21. "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain I have kept all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing is missed of anything that pertained to him, and has required me or returned evil for good. So and more also do God to me, the enemies of David, if I leave anything that pertains to him by morning light, anything that any male descendants that pisses against the wall,' as the King James says. All the males are going to be murdered. I'm going to kill them. Just going to kill them all. They don't deserve to live when they behave like that." Verse 23, "When Abigail saw David, she hasted, lighted off her donkey, fell on David before her face, bowed herself to the ground, fell at his feet, 'Upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be. Let your handmaid, I pray you, speak in your audience and hear the words of your handmaid.'" And she basically went on to reason very carefully, very cautiously, and yet very accurately. "If you do this, you'll be sorry for the rest of your life. Because now David's reputation will be, instead of killing the enemy, he kills his own people when he's insulted. He's such a small man." Now, she never used those words, but he's such a small man that he can't even deal with a slight insult. He just goes murdering people. So she was very wise. She preserved David's dignity. She didn't come to him and say, "Well, you idiot, do you know what you're doing here? You know what your reputation is going to be like if you do this? Everybody in Israel is going to hate you. Anything you hope for the future is going to be destroyed." She could have said those things. She was right. She would have been right. But she just basically said, "Please think about this. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what I see. Yeah, you have a right. You've been insulted. Shouldn't have been." But she reasoned with him. She learned how, somewhere, to preserve dignity. Yes, to make the corrections that were necessary, she went back and talked to her husband privately, saying, "Man, you were a fool. That's how close we've come to death. David said he was on his way to kill us all. Now, Nabal ended up having a heart attack virtually and dying almost on the spot. Abigail ends up marrying David later on, a whole other part to the story. But here's a woman again who had insight in how to deal with situations in a gentle and kind manner, preserve others' dignity, whether dealing with other women or other men, no doubt. It's a fourth thing. What's a fourth thing we can learn from Deborah? And that is this: use your power to encourage others. Use your power to encourage others. Turn back to the book of Judges, chapter 4. Judges chapter 4 and verse 10. Remember this story as we cut into it. God gives a message to Deborah, says Barak is the guy to take the army to the area to kill Sisera and his forces so that Israel will be free from oppression. Barak says, I can't do it, I'm afraid. Maybe if you come with me, I'll go. She said, I'll go, but the glory of the battle will go to a woman. Verse 10. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh, and he went up with 10,000 men at his feet, and Deborah went with him. Now Heber the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tents to the plain, which is by Kedesh. And they showed Sisera that Barak, the son of Binoam, was gone up to Mount Tabor. And Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron, and all the people that were with him from Harosheth of the Gentiles under the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, you know, pause for a second, 900 chariots of iron, 10,000 soldiers were no match whatsoever on the battlefield for this kind of armor. No match whatsoever. In the Old West, one person on horseback could fight dozens on foot and be successful. The Comanches did it for generations in the Far West. So this kind of power was unheard of. When they knew 900 chariots, can you imagine that lining up? They would just run you over before you had a chance to do a thing. They just plow you right over. There was no hope. What did Deborah do? She used her power to encourage. Deborah said to Barak, verse 14, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera under your hand, or into your hand. Is not the Lord gone out before you? You don't have to fear these people. God is at the forefront of the battle. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. They rushed forward into the midst of what could have been certain death, but tremendous courage was given. Comforting words, brethren, can be very powerful to reassure each other that God knows our circumstances, to reassure each other that God will intervene at the perfect time and in the perfect manner, is very comforting, very important. We use our power to encourage each other, not to complain about each other, not to draw attention to each other's faults and injuries and hurts, but how to encourage each other. That's what the word encourage means, to give courage, to encourage, to give courage. I'll read to you 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 and 4. Blessed be the God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort. As we strive to be like God, again, 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 and 4, as we strive to be like God, we are people of comfort. Comforting one another. Verse 4, who comforts us in all our affliction so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction. God gives us comfort so that we pass that comfort, that encouragement on to others. That we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. Deborah learned how to encourage, to bring comfort by encouraging others, saying positive things, drawing on the good things, focusing on what's right rather than what's wrong. One other quick lesson, number 5. Deborah also teaches us this, her example. We should inspire others to achieve their potential. We should strive to inspire others to achieve their potential. We live in a world that mostly is threatened by potential. And certainly as the baby boomers age and have control, what's one of the functions or one of the issues in the workforce these days? It's grind between the olders who have power and the youngers who have potential, who do things differently than the olders. It's just the way it is. So lots of companies are trying to sort of, how do we deal with millennials? How do we still retain control and yet deal with these millennials, these different thinkers, these different doers, these people who want to come to work in something comfortable? Like, what's with that? They need to wear a suit and tie like I had to. What do you mean they don't want to wear a tie? I'm not saying that there isn't a time and a place for tie, suit and tie, etc., as you know. But inspire others to achieve their potential. Turn back to Judges chapter 4. Pick it up in verse 15. They start down the hill with 10,000 men. And the Lord, verse 15, discomfited Sisera and all his chariots. Thanks to what Deborah was able to do and encourage Barak, he reached his potential. She didn't do it for him. She inspired him. She encouraged him. And he did it. Verse 2, verse 15, the Lord discomfited Sisera and all his chariots and all his hosts with the edge of the sword before Barak, so that Sisera lighted down, as the King James says, off his chariot and fled away on foot. That's a nice way of saying the guy was scared spitless and ran for his life. He jumped off this chariot because he knew he was a dead man if he didn't. Ran for his life. Verse 16, Barak pursued after the chariots and after the host unto Harosheth of the Gentiles. And all the host of Sisera fell upon the edge of the sword. There was not a man left. It was a slaughter. God gave them outstanding victory. Verse 17, howbeit Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael, wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. There was this buffer area. But she realized what an evil person had come into her tent. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn in, my lord. Turn into me, fear not. And when he had turned into her, into the tent, she covered him with a mantle or a big blanket, a big rug. So he thought he had received a place to stay, that he was safe. And you remember the rest of the story. Now I wonder if Deborah's example did not inspire Jael as well, or Yael, as we would pronounce it in the Hebrew. You remember what she did? Verse 19, he said to her, give me, I pray you, a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. And what did she do? She opened a bottle of milk, gave him to drink, and covered him. What is milk? One function of milk is that it's a natural sedative. That's why sometimes at night in the old days, someone couldn't sleep. What would mother do? She'd heat a little warm milk, feed it to you. Ah, tends to relax the body. Now, if you have a, lactose intolerance, don't try that. What is lactose intolerance? That's another new disease, sadly, that's come upon us. Like, the kids, you either drink milk or you didn't. Well, now, okay, there's other issues. To be careful with some of these things. Some people do. It causes tremendous problems for them. It's sad. Nonetheless, again he said to her, stand in the door of the tent, and it shall be when any man does come to inquire of you and say, is there any man here? You shall say, no. And Yael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent and a hammer in her hand. Now, we're not talking about a sixpenny nail. We're talking about a tent stake and a club. Kind of like a small mallet that you use to pound in stakes to hold your tent up. That's what she took. Again, was she inspired by Deborah's example, filling her potential in this case? It was prophesied by God through Deborah that a woman would receive the glory for this. And she did. Verse 21, Yael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent, took a hammer in her hand, and went softly unto him, and smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it to the ground. for he was fast asleep and weary. So this was Israel's superhero at that point. Action star. This was a gutsy woman. But she knew this was a very evil man. Had she heard that it would be a woman? Had she heard what Deborah had said, that a woman would take the glory for this putting to death of an evil and vicious person? I mean, this must have been a strong woman, I'll tell you. Verse 22. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I'll show you the man whom you seek." And when he came into her tent, behold, Sisera lay dead, and the nail was in his temples. I mean, the first big blow would have done the job, and she pounded it a few more times till he was literally nailed to the ground. Talk about a vicious, vicious man meeting his vicious end. How poetic is that justice in that sense? Now, I wouldn't want to be neighbors with Yael myself, but I'm sure she was a very wonderful woman otherwise. But maybe she received her inspiration from Deborah as well. Last but not least, what do we learn from Deborah? Number 6, give the credit to God. Give credit to God. We come into the next chapter, and it's where we excerpted that small bit about Deborah being the mother to Israel, guiding Israel, teaching Israel, correcting Israel where necessary, mothering them in a wonderful way. Judges chapter 5 and verse 1. Did she take the credit, or did she understand that God was working through her? Then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, that day, saying, "Praise you the Lord for the avenging of Israel." Where did the credit go? Not to Barak, not to Deborah, not to Yael, but to God. When the people wittingly offered themselves, there's the key. They trusted in God, they turned to God, God blessed them. "Hear, O kings, give ear, O you princes. I will sing to the Eternal. I'll sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. Lord, when you went out of Seir..." Who marched down the hill? 10,000 soldiers. Who was there? God was in front of them. "When you marched out in the field of Edom, the earth trembled, the heavens dropped, the clouds also dropped water." Now we understand why 900 chariots were completely ineffective. God sent a deluge before the army came out of the hills. And it turned the field to mud. And so a chariot of iron is fine on hard pack, but a chariot of iron in mud stops soundly. Verse 5, "The mountains melted from before the Eternal, even that Sinai from before the Eternal God of Israel. In the days of Sinai," and it goes on to talk about sons of Anath, the days of Yael, "highways were unoccupied, travelers walked through the byways." In other words, people had to go through the back roads because there were so many thieves and enemies on the main roads, they couldn't even march on the main roads. They had to sneak around in the countryside. "The inhabitants of the villages," verse 7, "ceased. They ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, that I arose a mother in Israel." What would she have been first and foremost teaching Israel? Obedience to God. Of course. Why would Israel turn? See, it wasn't because of Deborah's righteousness that God suddenly spared Israel and said, "You know, I like Deborah so much, I'm going to release Israel from its occupation." No. She was inspiring, giving God the credit, teaching people to turn to God. And as a result, they did. And as they did, God said, "I'm going to release you." So her great contribution to the society in Israel was turning them toward God. That's her great contribution. Verse 8, "They chose new gods. Then war was in the gates. There was a shield or spear among the 40,000 in Israel. My heart is toward the governors of Israel that offer themselves willingly among the people. Bless you, the Lord." So somehow Deborah seemed to be able to work with the leadership, helping these leaders turn to God, who could then help their people turn to God. When God saw that turning had taken place, then he released them. Still used Deborah and Barak and others, But it was a process of inspiring others, giving God the credit, turning people to God. That's what a wise woman strives to do. Verse 10, speak you that ride on the white donkeys, you that sit in judgment and walk in the way. They that are delivered from the noise of archers in the places of drawing water, there shall they rehearse the righteous acts of the Eternal. Even the righteous acts toward the inhabitants of the villages in Israel. Then shall the people of the Lord go down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, awake. Utter a song. Arise, Barak, and lead your captivity captive, you son of Abinoam. Outstanding song. Now we can go on from there. We won't. But giving God the credit, helping people turn to God, is an outstanding principle that all women, certainly all of us, should be inspired to do, to follow. Follow that example. Give God the credit for good, and help others to see that. Turn their hearts as well, as much as we can. Let's close by turning to Proverbs 31 in verse 30. Proverbs 31 and verse 30. What Deborah's life teaches us is that God has called many women into the faith with many different talents and abilities, many different skills, many different skill sets. We dare not look at our women as all yellow pencils, one just like the next, nor should we force them into a mold that is not necessarily correct. But we should encourage them to pursue their talents and abilities and skills, understand their potential, but also understand their role. That's, of course, a subject for an entirely different sermon. Deborah must have understood this close to Proverbs chapter 31 in verse 30. I'll read to you from the New American Standard Translation. It says this, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain." What does our culture usually inspire or encourage women to pursue? Those two things, charm and beauty. But they're only on the surface. It goes on to say, "But a woman who fears the Eternal, she shall be praised." That's what we desire. We desire to learn from the lesson of Deborah, not just for our ladies, but for all of us. So, brethren, as we enjoy each other's company today and over the weekend, we enjoy snackies together, let's do our best to honor the Mother of Israel by following her example.